All right, we're at Genesis 45. Remember last week that Joseph has revealed himself to his brothers, and we saw how they reacted to that. They were terrified, and this is, remember, 22 years since they sold him into Egypt. And so now, when he finally reveals himself, they're terrified. In fact, they are speechless. And so he begins to comfort them. I think we left off about verse 6, but go back to verse 4 and we'll just read. Really, verse 4 through 8 is a little section there. So it says, Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land for these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and Lord of all of his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt." And so it's that last part there where he's really trying to comfort them and letting them know it wasn't you, it was God. That's why I'm here. And one of the things, this is really one of the great statements of the providence of God. We have talked about his providence throughout this study, because really that's the main thing with Joseph and everything that happened to him. It's really due to the providence of God. But this is the first time that he has expressed it in such a way that obviously he has come to realize, we don't know at what point exactly, but he has come to realize that everything that has happened to him, from being thrown in the pit and everything imprisoned and all of that, was a part of God working out his plan. And so one of the things we take from our overall study of Joseph is the understanding that God does work in our lives. There is such a thing as the providence of God. That wasn't something that was limited just to the biblical age and biblical time. God does work in our lives, and it's important for us to understand that. And I think sometimes in churches of Christ, we struggle with that because we recognize we're no longer in the miraculous age. And so sometimes because of that, we think, well, then how does God work providentially? And we don't have all the details of how exactly God does that. But we know that through nature, just the natural course of events, God can use them to accomplish his will. And so, again, that really, if you believe in the providence of God, it can have a very positive impact on how you view things and how you deal with ups and downs and trials and tribulations in life, how you deal with brethren when they mistreat you or anyone who mistreats you and how you respond. And we see that with Joseph. Let's keep in mind, as we just read this, that Joseph, as we know, he's in this position of power, so he can do anything he wants to these brothers of his. If he was full of anger and he had revenge on his mind, they would have been in a great deal of trouble, because he could have immediately had them executed if that's what he wanted to do. And how many people would have done that? Like, you just think of the masses of humanity. How many individuals would have been so mistreated to the extent that he was, and went through all the things that he did, and then they're exalted to this great position of power, and lo and behold, the very ones responsible for all of his troubles are before him. There's probably the majority of people would have done something. Again, he could have had them executed, or he could have made them his slaves, and just sent Benjamin home, and that's it. Or he could have imprisoned them. Whatever, but he doesn't. Instead, he forgives them. And a lot of that has to do with his understanding of providence. And I know some of it is he loves them. They're his brothers. But I mean, how many times through the course of history, you know, family doesn't always matter, does it? Has brother ever killed brother or mistreated brother before? Go all the way back to Genesis 4, and we understand that has repeated itself over and over. And so just because they're his brothers, that doesn't save them. But a lot of it is his understanding that God is responsible for this. Like, how is he going to be mad if he really believes that this was God working his plan out? And obviously he does. How he can't be too upset with his brothers. And that's the very point that he is now making to them. It wasn't you, it was God. Now, does that mean that he somehow is naive and he doesn't realize that they did wrong? No. He, at some point in time, he'll bring it up again. He refers to it, their action, as evil. I mean, he recognizes that. That was evil when they threw him in a pit and all that they did. But he understands again that in some way, God had a hand in everything. He arranged him to get from the land of Canaan to Egypt to preserve life. And so that he couldn't be that upset. Like, his attitude is, move on. Don't be mad at yourself and don't be distressed, because this was God working that out. And to a degree, maybe a lesser degree, but to a degree, we can have the same attitude if we understand that God works in our life. And we don't always know exactly how or when that is. We may not know the details of it. But as I've said, I personally give God the benefit of the doubt. Could I sometimes attribute something to the providence of God that's not the providence of God? Yeah. Any harm in that? Not really. And so it's I'd much rather go on that side than for God to bless me somehow and me just say, well, you know, that was just kind of a coincidence. You know, I always think of Acts chapter 12 when the brethren were praying for Peter, and then Peter shows up and knocking on the gate out there, and the maiden said, hey, it's Peter out there. You've seen a ghost. not Peter. Can't be. And they're praying for. What are they praying for? And so, you know, you don't want to do that, certainly. And so let's just understand. It will help you. It can shape some of the decisions that you make and attitude that you have, again, especially when things happen. And God can really turn bad things into good for us if we have the right attitude. I think sometimes, and we'll move on to the next section here. I think sometimes, I've always believed with my preaching, with most of the places where I've preached, God has had a hand in me being there. And I believe that. Could I be wrong about that? Yeah, I could. You know, one thing about providence, it's not written. Things aren't written. But now, before I finish that, think about Joseph. One thing about Joseph is, so far as I know, God never told him what he just revealed right here in this little section. God didn't tell him that. How did Joseph know that this was all God's plan? He believed in providence. He believed that God was with him. He believed the presence of God was with him, and he knew and believed and had faith in the power of God. And when you just begin to piece together all the facts, he came to the conclusion, this was God all along. And that's pretty much what we do, how we come to a conclusion about things. I was saying about I can remember the first job I had preaching, the Spring and Delta Church in Long Beach, California, and how that came about. There's no doubt in my mind it was providence. It basically swung on a phone call, really, where their preacher was leaving and the elders asked him to help find a preacher. And his mother happened to be a member of the congregation I was a member of and said, you know, we know a young man who wants to preach. And one thing led to another. And Janice and I flew out there to Long Beach and I preached on Sunday morning, Sunday night, and they hired me that night. In a blink of an eye, I went to putting on camper shells to being a full-time preacher just like that. You think I should attribute a little bit of that to providence? Like, that hardly ever happens when you are, from a preacher standpoint, where you just go preach one time and then before you go home, you have a new work you're working at. And there are other factors involved in that I know of. And how God, but you know, just details, things happen. That, you look at the life of Joseph, there's all kind of details that had to come together. There's providence. He believed it was providence. I believe he was right. I think there's little doubt about that. And so, but when you believe that, and Autumn, I'll call on you here, but when you believe, if I really believe that, I believe I'm here at this congregation because of providence. Like, I've told the story many times about the Kilpatrick driving up Hard Drive, and that one thing led to another, and I wouldn't be here at this congregation if it wasn't for that. And so you know, stop. And I firmly believe in providence. But if I really believe that, is that going to have an impact? Like, if I believe I'm at a particular place and God had a hand in it, you think I'm going to quit the first time there's a problem? That's the problem I have when people come who, now this is off of providence, but you know, from time to time we get people to come who still believe in miracles and that sort of thing. And you don't know how many times. It's happened a few times even since I've been here. We've had someone come and they'll say, you know, I really like it here. God told me that to be here. And really? And then, you know, they start hearing some truth preached and they don't like it and they leave. Like, wait a minute, didn't God tell you to be here? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You wonder how that works out. But if you really believe something, you're not going to just quit because there's a problem. And so, you know, we got to think about that. But that really, providence is real. I don't know exactly how God works it out in your life, but it's real. Maybe next time you have a problem, it could be God reaching down and helping you in some way, teaching you something, learning. I've had a situation where I preached at one place with the situation was terrible, but you know what? I look back on it and it helped me. It helped me to learn how to deal with certain situations that I would, if I didn't experience that, I would know. That's providence. So go ahead, Autumn. Right, right, right. Right, and as I think about that, even with Joseph, and this is why it's important, even if we don't always know when something is providential, to at least believe God does work in our lives. Like, there's a whole group of people, and some in churches of Christ, who believe that God is completely separated from man. Like, humanists for sure believe this. Even most humanists are atheists, but their attitude is, even if there is a God, even if there is a greater being, he doesn't care about us and he doesn't work in our life. And there's some Christians who kind of think like that too. That God doesn't have any part in our life, in our day-to-day living. And that's just not true. God does work providentially in our lives. And so now Joseph had to believe that. And not only that, as he went along in life, you remember, we have seen through it all that he kept faith in God. When he was thrown in the pit, when he was in prison, when he was forgotten about, he never took it out on God. So he gave that providence a chance to work positively in his life. And that's why we need to have the right attitude when we're going through things in our life. It may very well be God working in our life, helping us to be better But if we lose our faith, it's not going to make us better. And we're fighting against God in that situation. And so as you just think about the overall life of Joseph, he certainly believes in the providence of God and states it positively here. And now he wants his brothers to know, you don't have to worry about me. Now I'm not going to do anything. And for the most part, we'll see as we read this, that they really come to this realization. Look at verse 9 and this next section. It says, hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, and you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here. And you notice it, three times there, he basically tells them, hurry up. You just think about Joseph. He loves his father, doesn't he? We have seen the difficulties that Jacob has had and the faults and flaws that he has had. Like one Bible person who has really had a hard life with Jacob. You stop to think about his life, and he really has had some difficulties in his life. And he had a lot of flaws. But you know who the last one to see a father's flaw? Usually the last ones are. Who is it? Right. You can have a father who's just a complete mess. You're not going to convince his boy that, you know, most of the time. And so whatever flaws we have pointed out about Jacob, Joseph, he adored his father. He was his father's favorite son. And you see here now, you know, Joe, he has shown a lot of patience as all of this, and he has tested his brothers and all of that. But now everything's to the light. Everything has been revealed. And he says, hurry, go get my father. And don't tarry, hurry, twice the hurry, because he wants to see his father and wants him to come down to Egypt quickly. And so it says, and then it says, he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. And so, first of all, he fell upon, verse 14, he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. I may have skipped that. But so he goes to Benjamin first, of course, his full brother. And he, you know, embraces him and kisses him. And then he turns to his other brothers. And it's the same thing. And as you read this, this is not like a group hug. This is like it would be in any other family. You go home for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, and you have a big family. And what do when you first see your brothers and sisters? Big old group hug? No, you go one by one, don't you? And embrace them and kiss them or whatever. And when it's time to go home, what do? Embrace, say goodbye. Might be tears, but one by one. And that's the picture here. He falls upon Benjamin's neck and kisses him and weeps. And then he goes to his other brothers one by one. And what a scene you can imagine. What an emotional scene that is. And remember, his brothers, as he's talking, this is just all one conversation. And so as he's talking, the reason he's saying all of this is because they're speechless. They're terrified. And so then he goes into this thing about the providence of God, and it wasn't you, it was God, and all of this. And then he falls upon them and kisses them. And then what does it say at the very end there? That last verse I read. What do the brothers do? Can you imagine that? Doesn't that all make sense? They're relieved now. They hear all of this about where his mind is and how he's thinking. And then they all embrace one at a time. And it's just a great family moment. And then they talk. They just sit down and talk. The fear is gone. And really, it's generally gone. There's one thing later on we're going to find that the brothers, the only thing that after Jacob dies, then they get to rethinking things. Uh-oh. Maybe he just, now that Dad's gone, he might take out his wrath on us. But at that point, he reassures him just like he does here. And because he really believed it was all providence. But you can just imagine, what was this conversation like? And isn't it interesting that the Holy Spirit found it fit just to reveal that to us, that it just concludes after his brothers talked with him. They were too afraid to talk to him before. Now they talk to him. And you can imagine Joseph telling them about the past 22 years and all that has transpired. And them talking to him about the 22 years, what has happened back home, and all of that. They probably had a good old long conversation, just talking like brothers. And it's really a beautiful picture of reconciliation and forgiveness and all of that. So, yeah, go ahead. Right. And you know, most of the time, reconciliation will be initiated by the injured party. And so you just stop and think about that. And, you know, when you're injured, I mean, you just think about that. You want things to get better. I mean, do you really want reconciliation? And someone has to do something. I know brethren sometimes who go years without speaking. Like, really? Brethren in Christ, yeah, won't even come worship at the same church building, part of the same congregation, walk right by each other. But can you? I mean, I've seen that with brethren, and someone has to put a stop to that. And a lot of it, I think Autumn's right. A lot of it is maturity. Someone has to be mature enough to do that. But what a beautiful scene here that we have with Joseph and his brothers. Well. Verse 16 says, when the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And, you know, just stop and think about it. This really shows the degree of respect that Joseph had with Pharaoh and the love that Pharaoh had with him. And isn't it interesting? It wasn't just Pharaoh. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants. Like, they hear this good news. That you know, Joseph's brothers have come and they know this Joseph is happy. He's full of joy. And Pharaoh and his servants were pleased with that. Because, I mean, really, when you stop and think about it, Joseph was their savior. And, I mean, it was because of him being able to interpret that dream. And he had the wisdom to tell them what to do. And now he's been carrying a lot of this out. He's sort of been the superintendent as the prime minister of Egypt, basically. He's been in charge of everything, and everything has gone smoothly. And if look over at Psalms 105. Let's read that. We've read this before, but I want to read the rest of it. We read the part, if you recall, Psalms 105. We read the part that had to do with really, probably his lowest point in Egypt. And that's when he was in fetters in jail. And you remember we kind of brought that out, that it wasn't all pleasant when he was in jail. Some of it was torturous. And this verse describes that. Psalms 105 at verse 16, it says, And when he summoned a famine on the land, and broke all supply of the bread, he had sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron. And that's what we looked at before. Until what he had said come to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. The king sent and released him. The ruler of the people set him free. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his possessions. We know all that. But look at verse 22. To bind his princes at his pleasure. That's how much power Joseph had. You think about that. Like the princes of Egypt, they were under Joseph. And it says, to teach his elders wisdom. That's a part of what Joseph did. He not only was the ruler, he was second to Pharaoh, in charge of everything, even Pharaoh's house, but he was imparting wisdom to the elders of Egypt. You think he was a man of great respect throughout the land? Of course he was. And the people loved him for it. And so when they hear, boy, he's reunited with his family. That was great news even to Pharaoh and to his servants. Yes.
So we understand now that there was no friction once Pharaoh knew that Joseph and his brothers were all Hebrews? Because I thought that would cause friction. It did before.
Yeah, well, no, it wasn't really friction. They just... Yeah, right. No, that was just a matter, and this will come out in this text too. The Hebrews were an abomination to Egypt. But that was more of a religious kind of thing. It wasn't really friction between them. It was what it was, and we don't know exactly why. There's some speculation. The Hebrews were all shepherds, and Egyptians despised shepherds. That was an abomination. That was an offense to them. And some of the things with cows and things of that nature, you know, they were sacred to the Egyptians. They were food to the Hebrews. And so there are different reasons why they may have viewed Hebrews as an abomination. So that's what it was. It wasn't so much any friction. It was just they couldn't eat with them, and they couldn't certainly live next to them. And so that's what that was. So yeah, it wasn't so much friction. In fact, it kind of gets uncomfortable when you read this, and Joseph is having to tell Pharaoh about his brothers and their occupation and that sort of thing. And you think, boy, that's pretty bold. You know that's an abomination to Pharaoh, but that's how much respect he had. He just came out and told him, yeah, my brothers and family, they've always been shepherds. And so, you know, Pharaoh takes it well. In fact, we'll read it here, but Pharaoh actually tells them to take care of some of his livestock. So that's the respect that they had one for another. All right, well, let's go back over to the rest of that in Genesis then. Genesis 45. All right, so he goes on then. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beast and go back to the land of Canaan and take your father and your households and come to me. And I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. And you, Joseph, now here's a reminder of who's really in charge. Like, Joseph is a powerful man, but he is second in command. And so it says, and you, Joseph, are commanded to say, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for the little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Have no concern for your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. And so Pharaoh's now commanding Joseph he's already heard this. In fact, a lot of people think that Joseph has even had a conversation before this with Pharaoh. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it does, it certainly sounds like that, as Pharaoh is telling them what land they're going to possess and that sort of thing, where, you know, Joseph just comes out and says, yeah, y'all going to be in Goshen. That's where you're going to stay. Well, later on, it sounds a whole lot like that's coming from Pharaoh. So some commentaries believe that they have already had a conversation. And that's kind of hard, Because sometimes it doesn't sound like that, and sometimes it does. It's no big deal. So, some verses make it sound like that. But here, Pharaoh is commanding him, and he throws in there the idea of these wagons. And so Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them, he gave a change of clothes. But to Benjamin, he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. To his father, he sent as follows: 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provisions for his father on the journey. So this kind of tells you why Pharaoh was so pleased with Joseph. They're doing well in Egypt, aren't they? Like, they have all these things just to give. And everyone else around them, remember, is basically in poverty right now. Even in certain parts of Egypt, in the southern parts of Egypt, and throughout all of Canaan, everybody is really suffering. The only thing that they have in Egypt is all these storehouses that have been set up by Joseph. So they have access to food, where everybody else has to come all the way to Egypt to get it. And so they're really struck, but Egypt is doing great. And you know, Pharaoh has all of this, and so he's sending all of this to Jacob. And so it says, and then he sent his brothers away, and now this is interesting, and as they departed, he said to them, "Do not quarrel on the way." Where'd that come from? Why'd he tell them that? Like, everything's going good and everything. They're no doubt happy as can be. And they have all of this, the provision, these wagons. Listen, it was pretty much unheard of for people to have these kind of wagons, carts, some translations say. The brothers, you know how they got to Egypt and back? They walked. And they had donkeys. They just loaded up the donkeys with their sacks and everything, and they walked. Now, they're going back home. They have wagons. And so they, you know, this is what. But before they leave, Joseph said, "Now, don't quarrel on your way." Why do you tell them that? Huh? Well, yeah. Good. Right. That's exactly right. They're worried about. He's worried that about just human. He knows human nature. Now on the way back, yeah, everything's good, but they might start playing the blame game here. This is your, you know, Simeon, this is all your fault. Oh, now you're the leader now, Judas. Your fault. You can just see them start bickering back and forth. And whenever family gets to bickering, that thing could escalate, couldn't it, and ruin everything. And so he just tells, listen, remember, I told you, don't be distressed. Don't be mad at yourself. So on your way home, don't quarrel. This was all God's doing, and everything's good. You know, just go back to my father. Go get my father and hurry and bring him back. Don't quarrel on the way. So very interesting that he said that. And then the last little section there. And so they went up out of Egypt, and they came to the land of Canaan to their father, and they told him, "Joseph is alive." And this rivals the passage where Joseph reveals himself. Can you imagine this, Jacob getting this news? Because as I said, Joseph really loved Jacob, but we already know how Jacob felt about him. And he has for years, for 22 years, believed his son has been torn apart by wild beast. And now they come back home. And they give him this news: Joseph is alive. He can't believe it. He doesn't believe it. He says, and they told him, "Joseph is still alive and is ruler over all the land of Egypt." And his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. Like, would you, if you were Jacob, you think you would have just believed that? And I mean, that what? Not only is he alive, but he's this ruler we kept telling you about, that he rules over all of Egypt. We found out that's Joseph. And no, that can't be. That can't be true. He doesn't believe it. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, and when he had said to them, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Really, when he saw those wagons, again, not everyone had wagons like that. These are the fine wagons of Egypt. And when he sees these wagons, he knows, oh, they're telling the truth. Joseph is alive, and he's revived. And so it closes then, chapter 45, by saying, and Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. So, what a wonderful ending to that. And of course, now he's going to make the trip to Egypt, and we'll get to that next week, and we'll try to wrap this up next week. There's not much. We'll skip several chapters, not several. There's only a few chapters left here, but some of this will be mostly about Jacob, and we're not interested in that right now, so we'll skip that. But as it ends here, here's Jacob. Now he's finally going to go and see Joseph, and then he says, "I can die." That doesn't mean he's about to die. We'll find that he lives for several years, 47 more years, I believe, if I'm right. Lives for 47 more years in Egypt, which is sort of interesting there. But we'll look at a little bit at the reunion and then some of the blessings that are there, and then we'll close that and get to Moses. So appreciate your attention.